Some very famous artists have generated a lot of noise from removing their music from streaming platforms. Then a lot of independent artists followed suit or had questions about it. But is this something you should do? We'll be talking about that today in this episode of the podcast.
You're listening
to the CD Baby.
CD Baby.
CD Baby.
DIY.
Musician.
Podcast.
Hey there, and welcome to episode number 294 of the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, where on this episode, we'll be talking about, we just called it, Before You Remove Your Music, Listen to This. So we're going to be talking about the idea of artists removing music from certain platforms for whatever reason, but should you? What are the consequences of that? We will get into all of that today. My name is Kevin Bruner. Joining me is Chris Robley. Chris, how you doing?
I'm good. I'm also just realizing that by the end of this episode, we might know whether we should remove our podcast from certain platforms. The answer is probably going to be no, but teaser alert.
Yeah.
It's good to see you not in real life. I know we just saw each other in real life.
I know. And it's weird because you and I have worked together for 16 years, which means there's a lot of experiences we've had together, but it was shocking when I realized when I saw you in Austin a couple days ago that it's been 2 years since I'd seen you in person and been in the same room with you. But we do this podcast every week. It was just weird. Very weird.
Yeah, you were like, ooh, in real life, he's really looking pretty haggard. Pandemic hasn't been so kind to you, Chris. What happened?
No, you looked amazing, Chris.
Thank you.
Just as hot as ever.
I'm glad I was looking good because it was a long flight, which should have been like a 7-hour trip turned into a 20-hour trip. So our dinner was, I was pretty tired.
Yeah. Next time, why don't you not take so many planes to get to Austin? That would be helpful.
Well, I would have liked it. They just canceled most of them because of ice.
Bummer. But you know what? As we were in Austin, we were there planning the 2022 DIY Musician Conference that's coming up this summer. But the thing that really jumped out at me, Chris, it's almost a theme for this, is that it's time for us to be together again. And the DIY Musician Conference is back August 26th through 28th. Tickets right now are just $99. You want to be there. Trust me. Just head to DIYMusicianCon.com to get your tickets. Just being with you and Christina there in Austin, planning the conference, getting excited about it, and just remembering how important that getting together with like-minded individuals is for your musical pursuit. And that's one of my favorite things about being at the conference. Being a musician can be a lonely endeavor. A lot of us do it. You know, we have family that don't get it. You know, like, when are you going to go get a real job, or when are you going to stop screwing around with that guitar? And they just don't understand what it's like to be an artist. But over the last couple of years, it's been even lonelier. A lot of us have been isolated and feeling disconnected. And it's so important to get together with like-minded individuals, get excited about your music career again, make those connections, find collaborators, have some showcase opportunities, and just learn a lot of cool stuff, because so much has changed over the last 3 years since we've been together. So just for the sake of it being good for your soul, you should come to the DIY Musician Conference, Austin, Texas, August 26th through 28th, DIYMusicianCon.com for your tickets. And if anything, there's rumors that there'll be an epic pool party afterwards.
Yeah, you know, like, it was interesting as we were planning, as we were there in Austin, in real life, planning this event, and thinking of all the sort of experiential things that people are going to benefit from if they're there in real life, all together as a community. We had this moment after about a 2 or 3 hours of planning session. We were like, oh my gosh, like, this meeting right now is what we want to happen at the conference. In the course of 3 hours, we achieved what we probably would have gotten done in like 2 weeks on Zoom. And it was like, Wow, things happen way quicker. You know, there's no lag time on whatever, no latency on reading someone's emotional facial expressions. And I felt really alive again in an interesting way. It was like, wow, I've missed just brainstorming in a room with people.
Yeah. So. Yeah. It's amazing how much you can accomplish with people together in the same room. and we're looking forward to it. Tickets are just $99. That will go up soon. And you want to get in at the $99 price. So you know the place. All right. We've got some calls and emails and such about NFTs that we'll be getting to later and some other topics. So that's always fun. And a reminder, you can weigh in on anything we discuss on the podcast or something we don't discuss on the podcast. You can do so by calling 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. Or if you're watching it on YouTube, you can leave a comment and we will share some of the feedback we get in questions. So today, Chris, we're talking about, before you remove your music, we want artists to listen to this, because should you remove your music? What are the consequences? Do you know why you're removing your music in the first place? And it seems to be something we get asked more and more. And it's been something that even just as we moved to streaming, we started hearing about. But you've got a brief history of the topic for us.
Yes. So it seems like ever since digital music became a thing, there have been various complaints from rights holders, whether they be songwriters, labels, independent artists, famous, wildly rich artists. Everyone has had their own little angle on why they feel like they're missing out, being taken advantage of, stolen from, you know, their rights are being violated in some way. And I do think throughout the last 25 years or so, or whatever, you know, ever since Napster, some complaints have merit. And sometimes I feel like it's almost like a strange form of scapegoating, like you're scapegoating technological advancements for your life getting harder as an artist, or new challenges you have to face. Yeah, right. So there's some amount of scapegoating. And then I also feel like there's a little bit of comparing apples and oranges when it comes to business models or royalty payment structures. So I think in this episode, we're really kind of speeding through a lot of that history and getting up to about a month ago when Neil Young famously said, "I'm going to take my music off of Spotify." And for him, it was a protest against the fact that Spotify had become sort of the main platform for Joe Rogan, paid him a bunch of money, that he was objecting to some content that Joe Rogan was putting out. Then in the wake of that, a bunch of other famous artists like Joni Mitchell and Nils Lofgren and India Ari, and the list is fairly long, also said they were removing their music. And then this is the message started getting a little weird. Some of them were on board with Neil that it was about speech or about the opposite of speech. You know, objection, voice, objecting to the fact that Spotify was platforming someone who they didn't like the content. While others were talking about payment and, you know, lack of payment, lack of fair royalties, or what they perceive as fair royalties. And I was like, wait, what is this all about? Is it speech? Is it payment? What's the deal? And then, you know, while my mind was trying to get wrapped around that, then I started to see on Twitter all these indie musicians starting to remove their music, or even just asking the question, you know, can I remove my music from such and such service if I use CD Baby's distributor? So then I started to get concerned. So we should talk about this. Is that a decent history? Did I forget anything?
Yeah.
In the story?
Yeah. I think you covered it all. And like you said, we've had artists asking these questions since the rise of digital music. And then I think for a number of different things, not even just related to streaming, over the years, we've seen a major label or a very, very famous artist do something, and then a lot of independent artists follow them as if that person is supposed to be an example for us of how to proceed in the music business. I don't know why that connection gets made, but that seems to be the case. And the big frustration for us initially is artists not understanding the consequences that they may face that major label artist will not face, or how their career is different than where most of us find our career. And our needs and our goals and objectives are different than what that artist at the mainstream, a major label level, what they're looking to do. So that, I think, is a trend we've seen. And so we figured it needed to be addressed.
Yeah. And then my concern about this whole topic is that even if you have a clear idea of what you are protesting against, whether it's payment or content or whatever, it's a lot grayer of an area. There's a lot of nuances to the topic. So if you're objecting to, let's say, what you perceive as small payouts, there's a lot of things we need to discuss so that you truly understand whether you should even be protesting in that way. So yeah. I'm just worried people made a lot of knee-jerk reactions and made decisions that they will second guess or regret in 3 months' time. But we'll get into all those.
Yeah, this is not a clear-cut topic, so your decision should not be knee-jerk. And I like what you just said about if you are trying to start a movement to get independent artists to remove their music because of a protest against payments, which I have seen. Probably a low moment was at one of our conferences. Someone from the stage said artists should all band together and remove their music from Spotify. And I'm sitting in the front row dying 1,000 deaths.
Awkward.
Because, awkward. Because if you are truly protesting the payout structure in streaming, one, does removing your music from Spotify even matter in that sense? Is anyone going to take notice? Two, is the message being sent to the right people? And I don't know if I have a third one. It's just like, what are you trying to accomplish? Like, if you, the knee-jerk reaction is what I worry about with most artists. But, you know, one thing that we should say, and through this we found out, apparently CD Baby is the easiest platform if you do want to remove your music from a particular service. Apparently it's super easy to do. However, once it's removed, it does not go back easily. That's the main issue I want artists to be aware of, where those major label artists, their music might actually end up back there a few months later, a few weeks later, quietly, without making a fuss.
Yeah.
But it's not as easy for us independent artists.
Yeah, well, we have a lot of things to dig into. I think the first question I have is, do these legends even own their catalogs? I don't know in Neil Young's case, but you know, imagine any famous artist says, I'm moving my music off of Spotify or off of whatever platform. Okay, your music, in quotes, is that the music that you put out independently after you were wildly famous because you don't own the rights to what you released under Universal or Capitol Records or whatever? Can you even remove it? Does that mean you're removing like one single that came out like a month ago, but like you're the stuff that everyone's really listening to, like your old hits, is still up there? Or are you in charge of your whole catalog and you can truly pull it? That's my first question. Like, what is the sort of the severity or the level of commitment you are putting into this boycott? The other thing is, in recognizing that famous artists often don't own their catalog, it also puts into question how they're complaining about royalties, because major labels have been known to do a whole lot of sketchy accounting or even clear-cut accounting that is just not in favor of the artist. So like, oh, okay, famous artist X says that they make no money from streaming. Well, maybe that's because your label literally takes most of the money. Or maybe you have lots of collaborators and you're splitting it a bunch of ways. So you sort of have to understand the economics. It's very different than a independent songwriter who writes their own music, owns their own master recording, and when they get paid, they truly know what they're getting paid because literally 100% of it goes to them minus any sort of distribution cut. But that's the next thing I have to say, is just like, don't always take the complaints of famous people as a reflection of your economic situation.
Yeah, there's one thing that you point out there that I think is really important, and a lot of the all artists should remove their music from streaming services mantra out there, oftentimes I see driven by artists that aren't at the mega star level, but are at a label level, maybe a decent size label. And they've just signed bad label deals, like saying, my song was streamed a million times. I saw this one just a couple weeks ago. My song was streamed a million times and I only made $50. Well, you signed a bad deal, because even with streaming economics, you should have made, I think it's about $5,000 or something, which isn't what I think artists have in mind when they see a song being streamed a million times, but it's not $50.
The song I have that's done very well, I even have collaborators on where I'm splitting the royalties, and I've made way more than that from that song. So
yeah,
they got a bad deal.
Yeah. So that's one thing, like all these things that oftentimes we tend to look at major label artists and feel like, oh, they're artists. We're in the same boat. And in many cases at a creative level, and how they approach music, there is an enormous amount of similarities. But when it comes to the business side, you got to make sure that they are actually putting their money where their mouth is, because oftentimes they can't even connect the two because it's not their money.
Yeah. Well, one thing you mentioned about indie artists, like what is the effect of your boycott, you know, or whatever you want to call it, your protest, because you probably have a very small listenership if you're a DIY musician. So it's like a drop in the bucket. I would actually say almost the same thing about these super famous people. And I don't mean this to denigrate their music, but I think like Spotify doesn't care. Like, yes, I know that stat came out, you know, 3 months ago that said like catalog releases account for 60 something percent of all listening. But even defining catalog or legacy recordings, that's a huge, huge bucket of people. Like, so even if it's just Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, like, what does it matter? Spotify's still got Ed Sheeran and Drake and Billie Eilish. And, you know, those people's music could be defined as catalog, depending on your definition. So,
yeah,
I also just don't know how effective a move this is.
And, you know, what's funny with a lot of these major label artists, because was it David Crosby, like made a statement and then found out he didn't own his catalog. I'm like, a lot of these artists that are major label artists still don't know how the economics of their business work. I think some of them have just gotten so rich, handed over to business managers, and they just, you know, just give me my $1 million a month allowance and we're good. So
manage right.
my
well,
money
it's,
for me.
It's weird, like, because someone like David Crosby, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, yes, I know their listeners, or, you know, sort of the bulk of their demographic has probably moved to streaming platforms at this point. However, that's exactly the demographic that still owns Harvest and Blue on CD and still has a CD player. So the effect of like saying you can't hear my music on Spotify isn't all that drastic when that same listener is like, oh, all right, I'll just put Blue on my CD player, as opposed to someone like Billie Eilish or Ed Sheeran, or, you know, Lizzo or whatever, someone who's sort of younger, contemporary, has a kind of a new music career. If those people got together and said, we're off of Spotify, that would be a sign of something, I think, concerning, because that's the exact demographic Spotify really needs to have as loyal subscribers.
Yeah. And that's what bothers me partly about this pull your music from Spotify thing we went through, is like all the artists that were vocal are artists where their demographics are probably the least to be impacted of their listenership compared to some genres or newer artists where their fans, this is all they know. And
yeah.
So it's easy for somebody who knows that all their fans have their music on CD to say, to take a stand. But for other people that depend on this ecosystem to reach people, it's different.
Yeah, and those artists have had three or four different chances to resell their music. Their legends, their careers are long ago made. And when I think about how this affects an indie musician who's just trying to build a career, it's like, are you taking a principled stance or are you truly punishing your fans? Because our last data thing that we did for CD Baby Payout said that Spotify accounted for, was it the 44% of our artist streaming revenue? So
yeah.
Just say that 44% of your fan base is on Spotify. So your principled stance is now going to like wipe out half of your listenership. And if you're truly at that point in your career where you're really building an audience, it also means they're probably not loyal enough to want to jump through any other hoops. They're not going to go subscribe to Tidal or whatever else to hear your music when they're already paying Spotify, that they like Spotify. And they're probably not going to, you know, go to SoundCloud or Bandcamp or anywhere else. So then you're really just punishing your fans. That is the biggest thing I worry about.
Yeah, I think that's something that artists have really struggled with since the adoption of streaming. We spent so many years in the music industry having one dominant format, whether vinyl, a CD, or downloads. And in those situations, you know, vinyl and CD, you know, you went to a store, you got the CD. But in the download era, iTunes reigned supreme. So it still felt somewhat similar, even though the economics started to shift and how much you got paid and all that. But then with streaming, we saw just a fracturing of the fan community and how they consume music. And so as independent artists, you are trying to reach as many people as possible. And that's why at CD Baby, we say we distribute your music to all these platforms all over the world, because for an independent artist, you want anybody who might potentially be a fan to have the opportunity to hear your music, because ultimately you are in that brand building stage where you are building things. You are not in that stage of just like, all right, I've collected my fans. Now, how do I best capitalize on this situation? Most of us aren't to that point yet. So it's like having your music everywhere is critical for people to find you, especially independent artists. When you're doing live shows, it becomes a little bit more obvious to you in the real world. When you go to a show and you're talking to people and this person says, oh, I'll look you up on Apple Music. Someone else says, oh, I just saved you on Spotify. I'll check it out on the ride home. Someone else says, oh, we use Amazon. Or they say, Alexa, play this band. You know, you realize very quickly that all those people, it's not like when they don't find you on Spotify, they're going to go, oh, wait, I've got Apple Music and I've got Tidal and I've got all these. So if you're on any of these, we're good. It's like, no, that's not how it works. Most fans are picking a platform and that's where they're going to go. And if your music isn't there, that's your loss.
You reminded me of one thing. You said all these older artists who are now removing their music from Spotify are the same ones who held out on adding their music to Spotify or to streaming. I shouldn't even single out the platform. They were like, no, we're not putting our music there, until they saw that all these indie artists were having massive success there and that newer label catalog was doing well, and literally streaming shifted the course of the music industry. Earnings were down, and then streaming was the one thing that reversed the trend. And so, you know, if this protest is about payments, what changed? It's the same exact payment model that made you jump in. So why jump out?
Yeah. And you know, what's funny with the stat you already shared that we also talked about on a previous episode of the podcast, that about 70% of music consumption now is catalog. And I forget what they consider catalog. I think it might be stuff that's older than 2 years after release. I can't remember. There's some metric they put in there. But that tells me that all these artists that initially were holdouts, that were major label artists, are the ones benefiting the most from streaming now, because all these people who can't get those CDs oftentimes, because a lot of them are out of print. Even a lot of top-selling catalog pieces are hard to find or out of print. That's the only way you can get to a lot of the music now. And so they've been able to access a whole new generation of fans from streaming. And so, yeah, you got to understand what's really going on. And you know, it's funny. I was just thinking that if all the independent artists pulled their music, that actually benefits the major labels even more. They make even more money. Because payments don't work like a lot of artists think.
Yeah. Well, we could just really briefly talk about the speech or content objection and then go to the payments thing, because there's a lot to talk about there. But so I'm kind of playing devil's advocate. Like, I can see both sides of it. And obviously, I feel like everyone should be empowered to make the decisions they want. And if you truly want to remove your music because you object to some content, cool. However, I'm like, you object to Joe Rogan's content? You know, that was on YouTube for a billion years, right? You know, YouTube has literally like all the content in the world. TikTok has crazy content. Twitter accounts. Like, have you been on Twitter in the last 15 years? Like,
I've been using Twitter less, because it's quite an experience now.
I was like, you know, you're everywhere else where there's objectionable things happening. Did you cancel your cable and internet subscription? Because literally the internet is just full of a billion things you could object to. I don't know why this one platform is drawing the ire in this way. Or I guess I should say, I don't know why they're exclusively drawing the ire, because I think the whole thing of social platforms is potentially problematic in this same way. And to me, it's like, I have no complaint with anyone who's objecting to Joe Rogan's content. I'm trying to call into question the inconsistent application of boycotting when you could probably find something equally or more objectionable on every other platform. So,
Well, and part of me with the Joe Rogan thing, my question is it partly because it was a different move for Spotify? Like when Spotify got into podcasting as a longtime podcaster, I was actually kind of concerned because I thought the beauty of the podcasting format is you get conversations about a lot of different topics in a casual format where it's more discussion oriented. And it tends to be, especially the early years, very lo-fi, but the idea is more community driven, more just feeling like you're hearing from real people, not this produced news thing or this produced TV show. And I was thinking that Spotify getting so into podcasting, they keep buying up podcasting companies, that it could be detrimental to the platform if everything is suddenly behind a paywall, because that was like the opposite of what podcasting was about. And so to me, that giant investment in that direction, spending a lot of money that wasn't music, I think rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
Yeah, and the more listening people do to podcasts on Spotify, it eats into the share of revenue that can get paid to artists.
Yes.
So I get that as well. However, we'll get to something later that is sort of the other side of that coin.
Yeah. Well, we can jump into your section here that says, if you're wanting to remove your music from streaming because it's about payment, well, here's some things you need to know.
Yeah, so first, almost all the other competing platforms have the exact same payment model. They take all the money that they earn from different tiers of subscribers, different territories, different kinds of listening, passive listening versus interactive listening, and all of those things generate a slightly different royalty. They put all that money together and then they say, we're going to pay this out based on market share. So the artists that get streamed the most get that proportional percentage of the overall subscription revenue. That's the sort of traditional streaming model, as opposed to something like fan-centric or listener-centric royalties, where basically what they do is they take an individual subscriber's money, say it's 10 bucks, and they say, well, this person listened to 50% the Beatles, 10% Drake, whatever that's left, 30, 40% something else. And then they paid that $10 out in that way to those artists. However, very, very few platforms do that. So most of them pay the other way, the same way Spotify does, which makes me say, why is Spotify getting all this criticism? The other thing I think we should remind everyone is that based on certain measurements, Spotify is barely profitable. If you look at their whole history, they've had very little time where they've reported profits.
One thing about the Spotify barely being profitable, I think, is important, because when all this stuff started really hitting the fever pitch, one thing that kept getting reported is they were reporting Spotify's gross revenues. And what wasn't being accounted for is after they pay out artists, how much money they actually have left over, because that money mostly is not theirs. So after they pay out artists, there's not a whole lot left over. A lot of that money they're collecting is going to artists. But on the flip side, people see Joe Rogan getting, it was reported at 100 million, but apparently it was 200 million. That also came out. I don't know if that's how much truth there was in that. They see that and they go, well, that's going to somebody specific. Why don't they break that up and give it out to all artists?
Yeah. So one thing I really also wanted to point out is Spotify is at a disadvantage when you look at them competing with YouTube Music, Apple, Amazon Music, because Apple and Amazon basically treat their music service kind of as a loss leader in a way. It's a way to sell devices. The subscriptions come bundled with Prime, or, you know, they come preloaded on your iPhone. YouTube is an ad platform. So just taking those three main competitors, they all have endless ways of making money. Spotify is an audio platform. Like, that's, I know they have ads and stuff, but like really their subscription revenue is how they make money. And so they are at a disadvantage, which is why I'm not all that upset when they started focusing on podcasts and kind of cutting into the music side of the royalties, just because I think it's something they're trying to do to stay alive and profitable when they're competing with people who sell devices. And
yeah,
I mean, in Amazon's case, they literally sell everything. So that's another thing.
Yeah, they are the biggest streaming platform that is relying on their streaming service being profitable in order to make money, where the other big ones don't. And honestly, when they got into podcasting, they had also talked that they were going to get into video, which they haven't yet. So my biggest concern was not the payout, but that this platform that was music-centric would start bringing in all the other things that are distracting people from listening to music. And that being more of a concern to me than the payout structure.
Yeah. Well, if we could run a few other things on a list, I think people also forget that streaming enables income from passive listening in a way that radio, terrestrial radio, didn't, because terrestrial radio, let's remember, only paid the songwriters and publishers. They never paid labels or people who own the sound recordings. So passive listening on streaming is kind of a whole new revenue stream. And that could be either non-interactive radio aspect of a streaming service or just playlists. So that's important when you compare it to how radio worked in the old days, as well as how label contracts worked in the old days. Like, there's potentially more money on the table or more percentage of money on the table now for you. And then the breakdown of Spotify's model is 50-something percent goes to the label or sound recording. I think it's 15% goes to the publisher, songwriter. And that leaves about 30% for Spotify, which again, like you said, is not all that much when you think about the total payouts they're doing. And then at the same time, if you're comparing it to downloads, that's the exact same cut that iTunes made. So if you think iTunes was fair and Spotify isn't, just remember they're making the exact same percentage of their revenue.
Yeah. And the passive listening thing you mentioned, I think, is really critical, because the streaming world has drastically increased music consumption because of passive listening. And that's places like your doctor's office, the dentist office, places where they might have had, you know, a radio station playing easy listening music before. Now they're playing playlists. And we've seen people, especially like solo piano artists and things that play chill music and music that's calming, just thriving from passive listening. Do people know who they are? No, but they're making a lot of money and their music is getting used and it's useful in the world. It doesn't necessarily mean they're on a big stage in an auditorium with 1,000 fans screaming for them. The way music gets used has changed a lot and it's expanded, which has been a big boost for all artists, but especially independent artists.
Yeah, well, so when it comes down to people saying streaming should pay more, like I say, yes, streaming should pay more. But the problems with that are, where's the money going to come from? Because sound recording rights owners and publishers can fight all they want between each other to get a bigger slice of the pie. Labels don't want to pay publishers more. Publishers feel like songwriters deserve more money. Great. But they're just haggling over that 70%. Spotify's already got those slim margins making their 30, so it's not going to come out of their pocket.
Yeah.
And then for most independent artists, when I look at my own situation, I don't give a damn whether the songwriters or the labels earn more, because I'm both and I'm always going to be both. So I get all of that. So what do I care who wins in that regard? I mean, in a selfish way. And then that leaves you thinking, like, where's the money going to come from? Oh, should it come from the listener and the subscriber? Well, guess what? I bet Spotify would love that too, because that drives up what they're making from that 30%. They would love to have their subscribers pay more, but they have market forces, competition, people accustomed to that $9.99 threshold. And I bet no one wants people to pay more than Spotify does. Like, they would love it. So again, do you want to pay more than $9.99 a month? If you are, like, cool. But I just think that it's a societal problem. It's a devaluation because there's just an endless supply of music. Blame that on economics, whatever. But like, it's not as simple as Spotify bad, they should pay me more. There's just a lot of other things in the mix.
Yeah, the genie's out of the bottle as far as these platforms existing. I don't ever see us going back. And if we do, it's probably some dire world circumstances that cause that to happen. And so I don't want to wish for that to happen and find out, oh, that means the entire world just burned to the ground. And so that's why it went away. And yeah, so I feel like what happened is that with the tech boom, especially when social platforms emerged and apps, the whole app ecosystem, all these people were developing businesses that did not make money intentionally, because what they were trying to get, the currency they wanted, was users. And then they'd turn and sell this company for $1 billion, and maybe it crashes and burns and disappears in a year. They don't care because they got their $1 billion. it feels like that's how a lot of these platforms emerge, that all we got to do is grab users. And so the economics of it are geared towards, you know, you got to grab tons and tons of users, as opposed to something that's a little bit more economically balanced, because all those tech companies wanted insane instant growth so we could go get tons of cash. That feels like how we've oriented ourselves on a lot of these platforms. And I don't know how you reverse that.
Yeah. Well, I think the last thing I wanted to point out is everyone objecting to payouts seems to forget that there's quite a few artists, and I mean like independent artists, making decent money from Spotify. Like, Spotify has helped them create careers. And I don't mean like five success stories. I mean, it's got to be thousands and thousands of independent artists who, you know, either have Spotify as a kind of continuing revenue stream that pays them well, or maybe they had a year or two of doing extremely well on the platform. And then just like everything else, things wax and wane, but they had that bubble of success that helped them build their career in other ways. Now they tour, they sell merch, whatever it is. Spotify is only one piece of the career, but for that year or two, it made them. So it's also a tool that is benefiting people. I'm not saying it's making everyone famous, but nothing ever has. Like, in the history of recorded music, most things failed. So don't blame Spotify for that.
Yeah. And I think what's important is that artists understand that you are in a brand building phase. And as, you know, Tom Jackson has said at the DIY Musician Conference, when he's done his talk, that major label artists are married to their audience, where independent artists, you are building that relationship. And in context, he's always talking about how a lot of artists see major label artists just standing there giving, you know, a very uninspired performance and everyone's still going nuts, meaning, oh, as an independent artist, I can go give a very uninspired performance and people should go nuts. No, those people are just excited to be in the same room with that person. And also there's usually a billion-dollar light show going on to distract. Whereas independent artists, we don't have that luxury. So I think for most artists, you got to look at this. I'm building a brand and I need to continue to bring those people closer and closer and develop that relationship, so I can ultimately own that relationship through them buying directly from me in my store, or buy other things that are supplemental to the experience, and not just trying to say, no, if you want to use my music, you can only buy it directly from my website, and then figure out how to download the MP3s and put them on your iPhone that hates doing that. And it's like, you know what? Never mind. You know, all I wanted to do was check out your music because we met each other and you said, hey, you should check out my band. And now I've got to jump through all these hoops. It's like, never mind. That's the problem I think most artists face.
Yeah. Well, if I sum up my thoughts around this, Spotify or any platform like this is probably never going to be the be all end all of your income. If you're an independent artist, you're probably piecing it together from a bunch of revenue sources, and you're always going to be making the most money from your most dedicated fans. And that could be merch sales. It could be vinyl sales, whatever, you know, concert tickets. But if you know that, then you could look at Spotify or any streaming platform as a brand building tool, a way to get passive income, a way to build your audience amongst new listeners. And if that's true, don't punish your fans by removing your music. Unless you have analyzed all of these factors and you still feel certain, then do whatever you want. That's my take. And if you really want to remove your music, CD Baby can help you with that. Just hopefully you've really considered everything we've said.
Yeah. My hot take would be that, here's my hot take. For independent artists, you should be focused on getting your music as many places as possible, so anyone in the world can stumble across your music, find it easily, get to it quickly, because the thing you want to make as easy as possible is for people to be able to push that play button. And then you work on building a funnel where they get closer and closer to being that dedicated diehard fan that will buy straight from you, the artist and your website. But removing your music from the top of the funnel is like turning some of the faucet off. And it's like these sources that lead people to your music start disappearing. No one's showing up at your website without some other prompt. So I think when you start removing your music from platforms, you start really shutting off that pipeline that's valuable to you as an artist, because what's important is for discovery yes, you want to get paid. Yes, you want to get paid the most possible, but it's also about looking at all your revenue sources and keeping your fans moving closer and closer to that direct relationship with you as the artist. But that's what we think. We'd love to know what you think on this topic. You can call our listener line at 360-524-2209 or email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. Or if you're watching on YouTube, just leave a comment below. Have you removed your music? Do you want to? Are you thinking artists are making a mistake? What are your thoughts? We want to hear about it.
Are you one of those people who removed your music in protest and then 2 weeks later was like, oh, what did I do?
Yeah. And one thing that I would highlight, because you mentioned this, at CD Baby, you know, we will support whatever you decide to do as an artist. We just want to make sure that you have all the facts and are seeing the big picture, because it's harder for independent artists and it takes more time and effort and some of our money when we make mistakes or pull music down and go, crap, now I need to put it back up. Where for the major label artists that say these things and sort of start these protest threads, oftentimes the consequences don't impact them as much. And we just want to make sure you have all the information and thought it through. So that's what we think. Speaking of what other people think, we have some calls and emails. So let's start with an email, because this one is about NFTs and this one was very good. So our last episode, well, two episodes, number 292 and 293, was called NFTs for Musicians, part one and part two. And we asked for artists to give us their thoughts, if they've tried NFTs or what they're thinking. And this is a great email from Max from Germany. And I'm wondering if we've met Max at the European conference. I know I did meet a Max, but I'm not sure if it's this Max. So here it goes. Hi, Kevin and Chris. My name is Max from Germany, and I enjoyed part one of your NFT discussion a lot, as it opened my mind to a lot of ways of how this technology might be used by artists in the music world. However, I would still like to advise towards caution and drive home a few points so artists don't have false expectations of what this might do for them. I occasionally advise some of my musician friends about the music business, probably similarly to how you would manage your artist. Most of them are not tech savvy and have a hard time managing the digital world currently and correctly and efficiently. Often I have to dissuade them from doing certain things that seem like they promise quick and easy success, like making viral videos, feeding social media and video platforms, playlisting services, etc. One in particular I'm thinking of would rush into getting into NFTs without considering all the risks. If it makes sense for his current business and fan base, the amount of work it will be to set up and manage, and potential pitfalls and scams one might encounter. So I would strongly advise your listeners to not get started with all of this just yet, but to keep learning about it and wait it until it has become more widespread and established technology. And he makes a couple points of caution with like a header and then a paragraph. I'm going to read the headers and some of the paragraphs. So point number one, an NFT is not a file and not ownership of that file or creative work. And I think this one's important because we talked about it, but it's important to reiterate. NFTs first started making sense to me when I thought about it on a government level. In a system where every passport is an NFT, you could never again fake your identity. The token, receipt, as Chris has called it, that is used to check the validity of said passport cannot be faked because it is cross-referenced through every single computer that is part of the blockchain technology where the NFT lives. So even if you spend $3 million on the Dune book NFT, which happened a few weeks ago, that does not give you ownership of the IP. And apparently the person that bought it thought they could make the movie of Dune now, had the rights because they bought this original manuscript or something.
What a letdown.
If I buy an NFT picture, that does not mean no one can right click and download it. It just means that you have undeniable proof of ownership of that one instance of a digital good, which is something we don't have at the moment. If anyone makes a meme with a picture I shot or makes a YouTube video with my music, then we currently have no way at all to verify digitally that the person has purchased a license or gotten consent from me, the creator. But with an NFT, they would. But that's all it is proof. And I really liked, that's why I wanted to read that paragraph. I'll go to his other, just have the headers of his other points, because I felt like he brought up a good example about using music in a video. there's no proof. There's no way I can prove that I have the rights to do that. And it's a big problem for people. And it's actually probably one of the biggest issues with Content ID on YouTube is that people have a legitimate right to use music, or they have done it in a way where it shouldn't trigger other things like Content ID, but it still does. A couple other points he had was, number two, some are estimating that a lot of NFTs will become worthless in the future. I would say that probably all of them are going to be worthless in the future.
Oh, that's mean. Like just 99% of them.
99%. Number three, he talks about power consumption. And the one stat he has here is that one Bitcoin transaction requires 2.26 million kilowatt hours. That is 15 times the amount it takes to make, it looks like 10,000 Visa transactions, might be 100,000. There's like no comma. So 1.5 million times as much as a single Visa transaction. 1.5 million times. Wow. I still, with the whole ecological thing, I still don't know how that compares to what happens when I do Google searches. Like if I do 100 Google searches a day, should I limit my Google searches? I mean, because I know that they ping all over the world.
I know, for one, Bitcoin is expensive like that because their consensus mechanism is called proof of work. It means they need lots of computers all competing to do this very laborious cryptographic stuff. And the winner gets rewarded. But so in order to get a transaction verified, you have lots of computers spending a lot of energy. There are a lot of other blockchains that do something called proof of stake, which is a lot more energy efficient. And even then, there are things like layer two solutions where like a lot of the transaction stuff is getting sorted out and verified kind of like one level up from Bitcoin. So you get a lot of stuff sorted out. And then once it's all sorted out, you just have that printed to the blockchain officially. And that saves energy, time, and money too. All that to say, there's lots of solutions in the works for the energy thing.
Yeah. Has anyone made a meme from Back to the Future using that scene where the doc finds out how much energy it needs to run the time machine for the flux capacitor? That would be a funny meme. 15
trillion gigawatts.
That would be a funny meme for the blockchain folks. At least that would help me make sense. Like the environmental thing, it's like when you start talking about kilowatt hours, it's like, hey man, I play guitar. I you lost me at 2.26 million kilowatt hours. Is that a lot? Is that small? I don't know.
Well, I guess blockchains just need to run on lightning storms that are hitting clock towers, right?
Yeah, yeah. We know where one happens. So Max's last point was it's not regulated yet, and there's the potential is great, but there's also great potential for abuse, which we've already started seeing like crazy. It was a couple of weeks ago I heard about a major marketplace shutting down because it was so riddled with fraud that they just had to just shut it down. And that is potential for problem. And it seems to be more rampant in this space than in other things that have emerged on the web that people are trying to adopt.
And there seems to be a new NFT hack like every 3 days now.
Yeah. Yeah. So he sums up, Max sums up saying, okay, I'll stop my semi-rant here. I absolutely love the idea of this technology and I can't wait to see where it goes and how the world will change with it. But as things stand now, I wouldn't recommend anyone to make them a part of their marketing arsenal yet. He said, sorry for the long email, but this was also for me to create more clarity on the subject. But thanks for your email, Max. I actually liked some of the things you said a lot. It actually helped me conceptualize the receipt thing, the way he put it, in relating it to like using a song on YouTube or some of the other things that you might have that there's no digital receipt that says you have the right to do this. I think that that was an interesting usage, a way to explain the technology. All right, let's go to our call that we have about NFTs because we have one. Keep this rolling.
Hey, Kevin. Hey, Chris. This is Steve Karasotis. Super excited to listen to your latest episode about 2022 predictions. Great episode. Really interesting. The part on the Nifties, I just wanted to share something that maybe would help shed some light. Maybe it's something other people have thought about or not. Don't really know. But anyway, here goes. My journey creating Nifties and trying to sell them and market them was quite an eye-opener. It was great to learn something new. but it exposed a lot of the cracks in the armor of what everyone's promising. First and foremost, it is decentralized in a way, so you do have some control, but, I mean, that's only on the surface. In reality, you can't really do whatever it is you want with them without paying quite a hefty toll or quote-unquote gas fees is what they're calling them. So if you create something, for example, and you want to freeze it, it's going to be pricey, which is not that big a deal because you don't have to freeze it technically on a blockchain. And for those of you guys who don't know what all that is, you can kind of Google it and figure it out. But here's the real kicker. You can't really give it away to your fans without actually paying to give it away. You can't gift it without being charged a hefty fee for trying to gift it. For example, I created like a Christmas song and I created digital musical Christmas cards and I tried to gift them to some of my friends and some of my fans. And in order to gift each individual one, just to give it away, the fee was like maybe 50 or 60 bucks. And that's per card or per song or per gift, however you want to look at it. So again, it's a big hurdle. I mean, there's a lot of potential in it, but it's still a big hurdle. And also, in my opinion, I would think that the only way that Nifty's will be a viable, honest platform in which to engage with our fans would be when we are actually able to encrypt them without anybody else and give them away or sell them on our own. And I'm sure that technology will come somewhere down the line. It's just not available yet. Anywho, thanks for listening, guys. Once again, love your podcast, and I hope to hear the next one soon. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Steve. And you know what? He solved one of the biggest problems that no one
Nifty
has. Yeah, he was calling them Nifties, and it's like, there you go. Everyone wants a Nifty. It'd be nifty.
Well, it's like there's the market. Yeah, there's the marketplace Nifty Gateway.
I hadn't experimented with it at all, but I think, have you, Chris? The transaction fee or the gas fees that he mentioned seemed extremely high from what I was seeing, but it may
well,
be that
it sounds like he's talking about Ethereum. Ethereum is currently both the most substantial, significant place to mint and sell NFTs. Mm-hmm. It's where the biggest sort of prestige NFT sales have happened. All the kind of the whales, like the, you know, the rich crypto people are usually on Ethereum looking for the next NFT purchase. And they also have very high gas fees. So he's right in that. However, there are other blockchains that have a lot cheaper gas fees, like Harmony has. I'm not sure if they have many NFT things happening there, but that has like gas fees that are fractions of a penny. So it doesn't have to be as significant as that. It could be, hey, I'm giving away my Christmas song and everyone has to just pay a penny. Or the hurdle still remains that you need someone to have a crypto wallet with crypto in it, which is a lot to ask sometimes. But the other thing I'll say is on Ethereum, they're working to make it a lot more scalable in that way. So the transaction fees will be a lot less eventually.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in, Steve, and detailing that because, you know, that's where it's new and it's interesting to hear what people are running into and how they're trying it and so forth. All right. We've got a couple more emails. This was a comment off of our one of our YouTube videos about NFTs. So again, if you want to weigh in, if you're seeing a video of this, of any of the content, you're more than welcome to weigh in on a comment there. And we might use it on the show. But this is from Mike Levitt. For me, the easiest way to think of an NFT is as a digital signature. That's what it feels closest to me. The signature side of the term digital signature denotes how an artist or company has put their personal mark on something to give it value related to the signer. Maybe the value is in IP or collectability, or just simply a fan's love of something or someone. It's like an artist who signs their work or a certificate of authenticity, depending on who makes it and what they made it for. It makes it unique and collectible. The digital side of that digital signature is where you get utility because you can have it on your phone and it's verifiable at an event, performance, online forum, or whatever. Calling it a digital signature just makes so much more sense to me. I think the reason it's called a token is because of crypto, which has a very tech and programming heavy lingo, but I think for artists especially, it would click if they realized this is a way they can sign a specific piece of their digital artwork, song, obviously. And then there's a bunch of cool ways to connect with the fans who invested into your digitally signed stuff. I don't know, but that's how I'm starting to look at it. What do you guys think? I think that was another interesting take. And I think what's interesting to point out from the three pieces of feedback we've gotten, a lot of it revolves around how it gets talked about, you know, and understanding what people are saying.
Yeah, I like that thought, because it's like there's the technical layer, the jargon. I think it's like an ERC 721 token or something. So that's technically what it is. And then they came up with this term NFT, and an NFT can be lots of different, it can do lots of different things. So it reminded me of just digital audio file. Let's say it's an MP3. That could be a song. We could call it a song. We could call it an audio book. You know, if it was the author reading, we could call it a voice memo. If it's something on our phone, that's a demo. I don't know if they're technically all the same file format, but you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah,
what you call the file technically doesn't matter. You should use the term of the usage. So to the degree that digital signature works to clarify what that token is doing, I'm all for it.
Yeah. All right. We've got one more email, and then we have another call. Here's the email. Hey, guys. My name is Brody Masterson. I played drums for 9 years in the band Lock Nine that is currently on hiatus, and have been since working to establish my own solo project that has yet to have a release. First off, I love your show. I've been listening for a couple of years, and the amount of practical information discussed is invaluable to someone such as myself. As for my question, in past episodes, you guys have mentioned having copies of your songs without vocals available for use in film or other visual mediums. Do you think that those copies should be made available for all listeners on all major streaming platforms, or just kept in reserve for those wanting to use them specifically in videos and TV? I like the idea of having instrumentals made available for all to listen, yet I worry that it may oversaturate my catalog for people who are not interested in instrumentals. Thoughts? What are your thoughts, Chris?
I think hold them in reserve for when you need them for special occasions like sync licensing and maybe giving them to your fans who want to do karaoke videos or something. But I would not necessarily put them out for everyone to hear. I think that might get confusing and feel a little bit anticlimactic.
I agree. I don't want a fan that doesn't know any different or may miss something to go to our profiles, play this instrumental version of our new album and think that was our new album.
Right.
It would just be weird. So
I can see situations where one or two songs that are really standalone as instrumentals and like are worth sharing that way, in which case, sure, do it once in a while. But I don't like the idea of like dropping every song on the album minus the vocals.
Oh, here's how I would do it. Here's how I'd do it. I would do it like a maxi single. Like, you know, we had that single, a song called Try. We had the official version and we had the rock mix version. We had the acoustic version. And then we had a dream pop version. They were all very different. So I could see in that aspect, us including the instrumental version would not be confusing and would also allow people to experience the song a different way. So that could be a way to do it. But releasing a whole album, like instrumental album, that's the same as your full length album, just without vocals, I think might be confusing. All right.
Yeah.
We've got one last call. Let's get to it.
Hey, Kevin and Chris, this is Jeff Iftikharuddin calling in. I just wanted to call and just say your podcast is so great. It's so helpful. It's really this comforting podcast. There's so much amazing information. I've been working my way through all of the episodes. It is so incredibly helpful in so many different ways. You guys helped me out a couple of years ago when I was changing my name back to my using my real full name. Feels really good. And I'm having so much fun, and I'm able to implement everything that I learned listening to you guys. It's hilarious. And it's, again, I just find it to be really comforting. A lot of times you can get overwhelmed as a DIY musician when you're doing everything by yourself. But I've really learned how to use so many different tools to make it easier. I also have a suggestion. I think, Chris, if you did like a rant, that would be, when you rant, it's one of the funniest things. I love Chris's rants, Rob Lee's rants, something like that. They're so great. But yeah, just huge thanks for everything you guys do.
Thanks for the call,
How
Jeff.
How dare you? That is one of the stupidest ideas I've ever heard of. Just kidding. Thanks.
There's the one. I knew I had somewhere where someone was saying that they needed more rants from Chris. And because we were talking about it, I was looking for it. I'm like, I know somebody said they want more rants from Chris. And yeah, it was there.
I don't think that was the kind of rant he wanted, but thanks.
We're glad that the podcast is helpful and we're glad that it's still rolling and there's still things to talk about. All right. Again, if you have something you want to weigh on, we talked a lot about removing your music. We had, still hearing about NFTs as those episodes are getting out there. We want to know what you think. So you can call our listener line at 360-524-2209, or you can email us at podcast@cdbabypodcast.com. Are you starting to book shows? Are you looking and are you feeling more optimistic about where 2022 is going? We want to know. We want to know your thoughts, the things that you're thinking about, concerned about, questions you have. Weigh in. You might be on the podcast.
Oh, you know what? Right. One other question we should throw in there is if you're going to the DIY Musician Conference, and you should, what sessions do you absolutely want to see? Like, what do you want to learn about while you're there? We probably have it covered, but it would be interesting to just make sure.
How about this? Not just what you want to learn about, but what you want to do. Because when you that makes me think that I'm sitting in a room staring at someone talk for hours and hours and on end. But that's cool. There's lots of stuff that you got to absorb that way. But what experiential things do you want to do when you're with a bunch of crazy artists in Austin in summertime? You know what we
Let
should
us
do?
Know.
We should do, Lady Bird Lake, which is actually a river that goes through Austin, Texas. I noticed while we were there, Chris, they rent paddle boards and inner tubes. We should just get an entire conference inner tube float down the river, like 1,500 artists all linking arms floating down the river together. We'd probably make the news too. So we want to know, what do you want to experience while you're in Austin? How can we make this the best conference ever? And we hope to see you there. Again, you can get tickets at DIYMusicianCon.com. They're $99 right now. Don't wait to get them. You want to be there. Trust me. It was delightful to see you in person. You're not just an avatar or person in a box on my screen. You are real. That was good to verify.
Yes, it was really good to be with you in the real world. And if anyone wants to see a picture of me on a jackalope, it probably won't
you
be
can
on
follow
CBS
me on Instagram. It's on my account, my Instagram account. You can see myself, Chris, and Christina all individually riding a jackalope, which, I mean, come on, we had to do it.
It was there.
Well, we're talking about jackalope, so I think this podcast episode is officially at the end. And
peace.
And we will catch you next time. Take it easy. See ya.
You've been listening to the CD Baby DIY Musician Podcast, broadcasting from Portland, Oregon, USA.